if every day is too similar to the day before, it makes time pass so incredibly quick because you can't differentiate between your days. And so I really do try and live, like, even when I'm not off on a big adventure, just on a, you know, day-to-day basis at home, I do try and live with quite an adventurous mindset. And I do try and do things that scare me a little and kind of, I don't know, make every day a little bit different. And therefore, each day is extraordinary because it's not the same as the one before.
That's Katie Jane Lerpinière, up next on the All Things Risk podcast. Welcome back to the All Things Risk podcast. My name is Ben Cattaneo. I'm your host. This is my show. This is where we go long form and tackle risk and uncertainty across all walks of life. And my objective for these conversations is that we become better at embracing uncertainty so that we can do two things. One is to live more fulfilling lives, and two is to, in small ways, perhaps, and maybe big ways even, make the world a bit of a better place. So, let's get right into this episode. And it's a fun one about adventure, taking risks, dealing with difficult moments, facing the unknown, and tons more. And one of the types of people that we like to talk to here on the podcast are adventurers. And that's because adventure captures so much about risk and uncertainty. Adventures are a microcosm of what we deal with and face in our broader lives. And that doesn't mean that we all have to become epic adventurers, but if that sounds like I'm saying we should live our lives a little bit like an adventure, then you're right. And my guest on this episode embodies exactly that, and we can learn a lot from her. I want you to meet Katie Jane Lerpinière, aka Katie Jane Endurance, as her website goes. Katie is an adventurer. She's an endurance athlete, a speaker, an expedition leader, and an explorer. And she's done some pretty amazing, epic things. Stuff like being the first to trek the entire 4,500 kilometer length of the Great Wall of China, or crossing the Patagonian ice cap, riding the original 1911 Tour de France route unsupported, and last year being one of only 29 finishers out of 98 to complete the inaugural Silk Road mountain race in Kyrgyzstan last year. That's a cycling race that you may have heard of from our episode on Try Pakistan. We talk about all of those things, and in doing so, get into a variety of fascinating topics related to adventure and uncertainty. So things like what to do when things go wrong, teamwork, toughening up, quitting and comparing ourselves to others, fear of the unknown, planning, and loads more. So let's get into it, and let's go to the French Alps, where Katie is based. Here is Katie Jane Lerpinière. Enjoy. Katie, welcome to the All Things Risk podcast. This is going to be a lot of fun.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be speaking to you.
So you're talking to me from the French Alps, as we established, which I think in the first instance says that, yeah, you do have your work-life balance sorted, at least to me.
Yes.
You're normally based there, I take it.
The wind at the mountains and the sun is shining, and yeah, there's not a lot to complain about.
Oh, God. Okay, great. Sounds idyllic. Fantastic. So I guess to kick things off, and this is the only real set question that I ask my guests, and that is, when you get asked what it is that you do or who you are, how do you respond to that question?
That is a very difficult question because there is no set answer. I have done many things in my life and they're still changing by the year. Right now, I would say I am a part-time adventurer and a part-time web designer. I basically have to have a kind of normal job as well because it's hard to make a living out of adventure as much as it's a wonderful way to live. So I am a freelance web designer, but I'm actually in the process of doing some qualifications to become an expedition leader as well, so that hopefully I can do a little bit more, spend more time adventuring and even less sat behind a desk.
Yeah, fantastic.
But, so that's where I'm at now. But I have done many things over the years, so it is it's always changing, and I tend to do jobs that give me the flexibility to fulfill my love for the great outdoors and challenging myself, really.
That's fantastic. I'd love to dive into all of this a little bit more. And in particular, to understand how you got into adventuring in the first place. How did that come about?
Yeah, that's quite a story in itself. So I had a pretty normal childhood, but it was a horsey one. I evented horses to a fairly high level, and that was pretty much my full-time life. And then I went to university, and after university, I somehow, kind of by chance, found myself building a career as a model. I did, you know, fashion shows and photo shoots and body doubling a movie.
You were Cameron Diaz's body double in a movie, right?
In the holiday, yes. Right. It sounds far more glamorous than it is. But, you know, straight out of university, I was earning, you know, good money in what was retrospectively a very kind of easy, fun, fairly glamorous thing. And yeah, I never expected to be doing it. And it just happened and all was good. And I was kind of, my life back then was very much one of, you know, false nails, 5-inch stilettos, and a lot of makeup on my face. And then I met a man. I was on holiday actually out here in the Alps, and then through family friends, I met a French man called Tarka, who I can only describe on my first meeting as a really, really odd weirdo of a French man. I mean, to give you some idea of the man I met. Lots of us were staying in this chalet in the Alps, and on a ski holiday, and he came down for breakfast fully dressed in kind of Arctic clothing, you know, designed for -50, massive down jackets and stuff, and he had a skinny pair of polar skis under his arm, and somebody kind of, as you would, asked, "What are you doing?" And he very in a relaxed manner answered, "Oh, I'm just off to ski into a frozen lake to time myself to get out to make sure I can do it before hypothermia sets in." You know, that was the kind of weird Frenchman that he was. I passed him a couple of days later. He was skiing uphill, dragging his mother behind him, you know, while I'm doing my best to ski downhill. So yeah, odd man. But 4 days into meeting him, he asked me if I wanted to walk to the North Pole with him, which was I've had before. So it was a bizarre set of events, and over time, we obviously met on that holiday, and then he asked if he could come and see me, because we'd got on quite well, and he didn't really have much money, so he cycled from the French Alps to my house in Devon, 1,400 kilometres, which I thought was dedication. So, you know, so I heard him out and listened to him convincing me that I really wanted to go to the North Pole with him, and that this was a really good career move. And obviously at the time I was like, no, what on earth would I want to do that for? More to the point, how on earth could I do that? You know, it was a world I knew nothing about. Other than I'd heard of Sir Ranulph Fiennes, because he lived down in Devon near me, and I'd heard of tales of him, you know, chopping off his own frostbitten fingers with a hacksaw in the garden, and you know, I'd cried over breaking an acrylic nail. You know, we're worlds apart here. How on earth could I do something like that? But Tarka had an incredible way of, he just believes that all of us are capable of so much more than we think, which I strongly believe now too, but at the time I had not been convinced of this. And yeah, he just over months convinced me that, you know, I really was capable of this, and I should, you know, what have I got to lose? And so I finally agreed, but under the kind of condition that maybe I did something a little easier, just to dip my toe in the waters of this new world of adventure, and I suggested that maybe we could walk the Great Wall of China. It was one of those things that was on my bucket list of places to see in the world that, you know, we all have. I knew nothing about it. I assumed we'd go for a couple of weeks, take some pictures. It'd be lovely. I had no idea it was going to be 4,500 kilometers long. I had no idea I was going to be the first person to ever do it. And it turned out I could have walked to the North Pole 5 times in the distance I walked to the Great Wall of China. But once I'd suggested it, Taka, who obviously then was my boyfriend, ran with the idea, and there was kind of no turning back. And I swapped my kind of high heels for walking boots and left behind a well-paid job for a life of no money and death-defying experiences. But I would never look back. It's the best thing I ever did.
Such a cool story. How long ago was this?
2006.
Okay.
A while ago. Gosh, that's showing my age.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, great. Fantastic story. And can we maybe talk a little bit about some of these adventures that you did you have any inkling when you were growing up? I mean, it sounds like you had a bit of an outdoorsy type of upbringing, you know, horses and skiing and whatnot. But was there anything that you could trace back to your upbringing that, you know, that would suggest, yeah, adventuring is kind of in me?
I was definitely sporty. There's no denying that. It happened that the majority of my sport was on a horse, but you know, even at school, I was in the kind of teams. You know, sport was a fairly natural thing for me. And through my equestrian competing, I was very much competitive. I am very competitive. I had also a competitive dad, so you know, when we went to a competition, we were there to win, not to take part.
Right.
So that was very much part of many years of my childhood, and not so much adventure, but I definitely kind of through my university years and straight out of university, which actually worked really well with the modeling because I could earn, you know, some good, it was flexible, so I could earn, you know, work hard for a good few months and then I could travel. So I definitely already had a travel bug. So I was kind of sporty and competitive and had a travel bug, but a travel in a very kind of conventional way, you know, a backpack or I walked the Inca Trail, but I signed up to almost a package holiday with a bunch of 15 other people with their little backpacks and off we went. So I definitely had a love for the world and I was curious and I wanted to see things, but I hadn't, I think I was someone who was ready to be tipped over the edge. I just didn't know it probably. And if I hadn't have met Tarka or met someone like him, maybe I would never have done these things. But I was perhaps easier to convince than maybe somebody else.
Right. So quite possibly he kind of sensed that in you somewhere.
Yes, maybe. Cool. But yes, he believes we're all capable of everything, but you also have to want to. So obviously there's, you've got to find that in certain people.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, that's very cool. So walk us through, not literally, the trek around or across the Great Wall of China, if you could, or at least maybe some of the moments that you took away from that experience.
Yeah, well, the Great Wall of China was obviously my first adventure expedition. I've been very fortunate to do many since, but it still undoubtedly is the best thing I've ever done. I don't know if that will always be the way because it was the first, but it was incredible. And as much as I hate kind of saying it because it sounds a bit corny, it 100% changed my life. I am a completely different person from the slightly spoilt, useless girl that started that journey. It was 4,500 kilometers long. It took 167 days. Started in the Gobi Desert in +40 degree heat, and then walked through the China's winter down to kind of -40 degree. It was -40 for at least 3 months of the journey. So deserts, frozen lakes, snow-capped mountains. You know, it was really everything. It wasn't just, you know, at least if I'd gone to the pole, it was one type of condition. Actually going across China, it was everything. I cried pretty much every day for the entire journey. But that's, I've subsequently found, is just my way. That's my body releasing. It doesn't mean I'm going to quit. It doesn't mean I'm not even enjoying myself. It's just, you know, when things are a bit tough, my body just cries. And yeah, so 6 months of crying, but I still loved every moment of it. And lots went wrong. I was in hospital fighting for my life within the end of the first week. So
what
wasn't a natural.
What happened there?
Started in the desert. Well, it actually, the internal flight across China was pretty much directly over the path I was going to be walking. So I was kind of looking out the window, looking down over the Gobi Desert, which from up in the plane looked how I imagined the moon might look. I mean, just there was nothing there. It was just this lunar landscape. I thought, oh my gosh, I'm crying the whole flight as it is. Then land in the airport and get a taxi to the start line. Now, the start line is a tourist attraction of sorts. You know, it is in the guidebook, and it is a lump of rock, which is the most westerly terminus of the Great Wall. So you know, the taxi knew where we meant, and we got in. I don't think they've seen many Western tourists, but they definitely had Chinese tourists go there. So that wasn't too much of a problem to get to the actual start line. To get the taxi driver to leave us at the start line was a massive undertaking. Like a whole load of them gathered. They weren't going to leave us. They're like, no, you're going to die. You can't do this. I'm obviously crying, going, no, I'll be fine. Obviously, but I'm actually terrified inside as these people are telling me I'm going to die. And I'm looking out in all 360 degrees of nothing in every direction. So it was definitely a baptism by fire. But after a couple of hours, we actually managed to get them to kind of drive away, but they were shaking their heads. And then, yeah, that first week, it was so hot. We worked mostly at night, struggled to find water. And at some point in those days, must have drunk contaminated water, because I got gastroenteritis incredibly badly. You know how it starts. But how it kind of finished was I was unconscious. Tarka had to kind of make a little makeshift camp for me, where he left me with a sat phone, and then he ran kind of just to where the map showed the nearest road. That took him many hours. The road was actually just a line of dirt in the desert. He waited there again for several hours. Eventually a bus came. He was kind of, you know, jumping in the middle of the road, arms, you know, waving to try and stop the bus, which actually could have just gone round him because there were no edges to the road. But it did stop. You know, I'm 100% sure every single person on that bus had never ever seen a Westerner before. And there's this crazy man who couldn't speak Mandarin, who had to try and explain to the bus driver that he must head road to save this woman who's dying in the desert. And I think that took some persuading and a lot of charades. But they did, and as soon as they saw me, it was kind of military action. I was bundled up along with all my kit onto the bus. So I remember waking up on the bus, but by that point, my body had shut down my limbs. I couldn't feel my limbs. So yeah, it wasn't a good start. I was on a drip for 3 days in hospital, and then had to get another taxi back out to that spot and go through the same thing.
Well, this time maybe they might have had a point or two.
Exactly. So now they're saying, no, we can't leave you here. You're going to die. I'm not doing good at this. So my poor mother had grayed considerably by this
I'm sure.
already. And, you know, I'm only a week in. So, there was a lot to learn, a lot for my body to get used to. But it did, you know, you learn as you go. I did end up in hospital further down the line again with compression of the spine. I actually lost an inch in height over the journey of the trip, the weight of my backpack.
And there goes your modeling career.
Exactly. no return. So there were, I went, you know, a couple of times we went maybe 3 days without food. We crossed a lot of frozen lakes, which cracked and broke as we stepped on. You know, it was filled with issues. We had the worst snowstorm China had ever seen in 50 years, about a week before our finish, which meant everything stopped. Everything was kind of stationary. Mm. Cars were completely covered in snow, but we had to kind of wade on. So, yeah, it was filled with things to that could potentially have made me not want to do this. But the people blew my mind. They are still the best people I've ever met anywhere in the world. Just the hospitality, the how welcome we were. Although we went with tents to obviously wild camp every night, as it got colder and colder, when people did see us in little homes, which were often just a one-roomed home, maybe with three generations living in it, and they live on this, it's called a koo. It's a concrete bed, but it's also the table. It's two-thirds of the room, and the cooker is next to it, and there's from the cooker there's a tube that goes into this kind of concrete bed and heats it, and they sit on it to eat, and then they lay out their blankets at night, and they just move along a little bit, and we'd lay down next to them, and you know, six sardines all on this coo to sleep, although in China, most people are considerably shorter than us, so our legs always hanged off the edge, which was a little uncomfortable. We couldn't complain. Yes, we were fed and watered and looked after and taken in day after day. Just a wonderful hospitality, wonderful sights like I've never seen anywhere else in the world. And
were there settlements all throughout the length of the route, or were there times where you wouldn't have seen anyone for days?
Only at the very beginning, when we were really kind of right in the heart of the Gobi Desert, we'd maybe go probably 3 days, maybe was the maximum of seeing nothing. And then the settlements were quite regular, but they were very remote. I mean, the language changed from village to village, not even, you know, town to town. Some villages had never heard of the next village. I mean, they really, really were remote. I'd say 98% of the people we met on our way had never seen a Westerner. And, you know, I'm 6 foot tall, blonde hair, and I'm wearing a fuchsia pink suit from head to toe. And I just walked out of the desert. I mean, they just stared
at you're
us
an alien.
Like you're an alien landing. You know, it really was that, not fear, but that look of complete bewilderment. Mm. And all we had to do was smile. And they would smile, and they'd rush over and they'd touch our hair, and touch particularly like Taka, they'd touch the hair on his arms because they don't have body hair. And yes, we were a little bit like zoo animals at times, but we had to not get annoyed with that, because obviously every village we were the first time they'd ever seen us, so
that's so interesting.
We only went through kind of towns where, you know, we could actually kind of buy supplies maybe every couple of weeks, but we did see people as it went on most days.
I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the difficult moments, because it sounds like you started the adventure with a very difficult moment, but along the way you had, as you mentioned, you know, frozen lakes and freezing temperatures and whatever else, and it sounds like you kind of got a little bit, maybe a little bit calloused in approaching a difficult moment. I'm wondering if there's something that you mean, you said this changed your life, and I think going from nothing like this before to having done this, I can imagine that one of the shifts might have been how to deal with a difficult moment. And I'm wondering if there's something that you started to take away, or that you took away from that, around dealing with difficult moments that maybe you applied to further adventures down the road.
I kind of all the things I learned and can kind of take away, I definitely didn't realize until I'd finished, if that makes sense. I didn't feel the strength growing, or feel like I didn't have an understanding of how much I was changing actually on a day-to-day basis, or kind of 3 months in, I thought, oh, look how far I've come. I've got the hang of this. It always felt kind of scary and out my depth during the duration of the trip. And it was only when I finished and I could go, oh, wow, you know, and then it kind of changed my life. But on a kind of day-to-day basis, how I dealt with those issues other than crying was... I used, so we were raising funds for a charity, which really helped because it was the Make-A-Wish Foundation for sick children. And we had wonderful, wonderful responses when we did find like an internet. It was back in the day where we had to go to internet cafes to read our blog. There was no social media. And, you know, you're struggling and I'm crying and I'm finding it difficult. And then you just read some lovely messages from people who are going through so much, not out of choice, that really is enough to kind of pull your socks up and say, you know, you're completely here by choice. So that massively helped. I think the fact that every member of my family and every friend I had secretly betted that I would be home within a couple of weeks, proving to them how wrong they were massively helped. And I think that's my competitive stubborn streak in me. Not one person believed I was capable of it, apart from Tarka. And I think Tarka is just, he's fantastically encouraging, but with tough love. I don't think he'll mind me saying that. He doesn't pander to people. It doesn't matter if you're female or male, you know, our bags weighed the same amount, even though he's twice as strong as me. And, you know, if this is what we're doing, this is what we're doing. And I think if somebody had been like, oh, you struggling, are you feeling okay, perhaps I would have, I don't know, played a little bit of the inexperienced girl card there. And I didn't have that choice, and I'm really grateful for that, because it toughened me up. And every day it was always changing. So it wasn't a case of, oh, I've got the hang of this now, I know how to deal with X because tomorrow was Y, and I haven't got the hang of that yet. So it really was, every day was learning something new, but I don't think I really could reflect on any of that until it was over.
Isn't that interesting? I wrote down three things that were really, I thought, quite profound there. One was the importance of having meaning and purpose during a difficult moment. So what are you all about? In this case, your charity, because then that makes it about something bigger than yourself.
Yes.
And then the second one was being competitive. But in this case, you're kind of being competitive against yourself, right? You're competing against the person that you were. And and you know, I think that's so cool, and I think that's a very healthy way of approaching competition. And then the third one was around what you described with Tarka's attitude, because I think where your energy goes when something goes awry, and you can put your energy on feeling, you know, pretty lousy, or you can put it to something a little bit more progressive. And so all three of those are quite profound lessons.
Yeah, and I think whether it was rubbed off on from Tarka, or whether I've learned it from other people, or whether I just had particular skill sets, I have found quite quickly through adventure that I didn't know I had particular skill sets that work well with it. And I actually only notice it because I don't think of myself as I'm not particularly talented at anything. I'm not particularly experienced at anything, because all my trips are so different. I'm like a beginner every time I start one. So it's not like I'm a mountaineer and I'm a very experienced mountaineer. So it's only sometimes when I go on trips where I'm going, you know, with friends or something who have done next to nothing or not a lot, that I realize I have personality traits that work well that I didn't realize that were as useful as they are when I see other people struggling. And, you know, I might say something to them and they find what I find easy, very hard. But yes, so whether I learned that or whether they were always always
in
there.
Can you give an example of one of those personality traits?
I'm quite good at suffering. And it's suffering that is by choice. Mm-hmm. But I just a really like a simple example, you know, I was recently crossing the French Alps with my friend. We were kind of fast packing, hiking, but mm-hmm. quickish. And, you know, she was just in a low state, and we all get in those low states. And she couldn't think of anything else. And I didn't understand how she couldn't kind of, you know, I'm like, well, I don't know, think what you'd like for dinner, and we'll make sure we find like a really good place where we can have a steak if that's what you want. And she just couldn't take herself somewhere else. She couldn't not think of the pain. She couldn't not get angry with the pain. And I'm quite good at accepting, you know, even if I'm crying, that's why I say ignore the crying, because that's irrelevant. That's just a bodily function that's uncontrollable. Mm-hmm. But with my mind, I find it, you know, even if I'm really hurting or it's pouring down with rain, I can just kind of be quite acceptant that this is what the situation is, and it will pass in time, and not to let it get to me. And I didn't really know I had that until I see other people who struggle with that, and then I think, oh, that's quite a useful skill in these instances.
That is, and it's probably something that we can all develop. But you said something that I quite liked, which is it will pass with time. And I think that's great.
Everything passes.
Yes, yes. If you just keep moving, it will, you know, things will pass. That's a great lesson.
On the flip side, if you were to quit, the time would have still passed. Mm. So that time would have come when you'd have finished if you hadn't have quitted. Mm-hmm. And then you'll be very upset that you didn't. So, yeah, just not to get angry with things that you can't control. Obviously, sometimes we make mistakes, and it's very difficult to not be angry with yourself in those instances. But if you're in a gale, or you're in a storm, or your blisters are bad and you've done all the taping you can do to your feet, you just have to accept you can't do anything about it and think about something else. So, yeah.
Great lesson. Yeah. we've jumped around a bit, which is cool. I'm very, very cool with that. But you did have an Instagram post that I quite liked, which was the one actually around, speaking of quitting, you did have one about quitting, and I'd be just, that we're on the topic, I'm wondering if you could expand on that a little bit.
So this is my most recent adventure, January of this year. It was the worst week and the best week of my life in a really weird, the southernmost tip of Europe in Spain, with the intention of running 7,000 kilometers to Nordkap in the northernmost point of Europe, in the top of Norway. Mm-hmm. And everything about the trip was wrong. I didn't realize this, obviously, until I set off. In fact, I realized it when my mum came to collect me, to drop me at the airport. And it was all wrong. I could just feel it in my tummy that it was wrong, but I convinced myself it was just nerves and you'll be fine when you get going and, you know, off you go. And so I started the journey. The plan was for the first 3 weeks to do average a marathon a day, and then go up to about 50 kilometers a day to cover the distance. I was carrying everything on my back, so it was running's probably not the best term, because it was more of a shuffle.
It was a hike, right.
You know, I was in running kit and I did run, but it was you can walk probably the same pace because of the weight of the pack. But I was only out there for 6 days, and I managed the, I averaged a marathon a day. I actually unknowingly broke my foot on day three. I heard it go, and the pain was immense, but I actually convinced myself that it was my mind playing tricks on me, wanting an excuse to stop, because I was hating it so much that I was telling myself, no, you haven't injured yourself. That's just the part of you that's not liking this, trying to find a way out. And so I convinced myself that I was fine, not that I'd broken my foot. I managed 48K on it the day that I did it, and then two marathons after that. But I just, every, I it just wasn't for me. And I've never quit anything in my life. Mm. You know, sometimes things go wrong and you injure yourself, or, you know, you get ill and you can't finish what you started, and that hurts and it's hard. Mm-hmm. There's no pretending it's not hard. It's hard to deal with because you put your heart and soul into these things. But this was just a pure not wanting to be there, not wanting to do it. I was actually getting quite angry. I felt like I was wasting days of my life and wasting hard-earned money being miserable. And that's not what it's all about. So on day six, I just said, that's it. I'm going home, you know, after 6 days of what's supposed to be a seven-month expedition. And really strangely, it wasn't a hard decision. I was happy. I never thought quitting anything could be so easy. But it's just because it was so wrong for me. And the reasons I was there were wrong. Some massive, massive errors. I don't know if it was a midlife crisis, because I'm 40 this year, or I just got caught up in this current social media world where we are completely... constantly comparing ourselves to each other. But I think subconsciously I kind of thought, you know, years gone by, you know, I was competitive on the horses, I did very well, I then went on to modeling, which is, you know, quite cool, and then before I knew it I was doing world first expeditions, and I was on, you know, TV couches talking about them, and guests on cooking programs, and speaking to big corporate companies around the world, and then I kind of thought, gosh, am I best days done? But I didn't know this was my thought process. It was very clear when it came to me, but before the trip, and I had convinced myself that I needed to do something massive. I needed to do another world first. You know, no woman has run across Europe, and I made that mistake. Now, like, it's so obvious when I look back at the things I have done that happen to be records or happen to be first. I didn't know that when I chose the trip. You know, when I decided to go to the Great Wall of China, it's just because I really wanted to go to the Great Wall of China. And the record was completely a secondary thing, as where this was the wrong way around. You know, I was running along the dual carriageway, you know, hard shoulders of dual carriageway. I was passing daily kind of, I don't know, cafes with English fried breakfast on the menu. And
not quite an adventure in the same sense.
Yeah, and I'm all about being as far away from human beings as possible. And, you know, I love the element of looking after yourself on a primal level that you can only really get when you're in a really remote part of the world. And I was just, running along what is lovely for a holiday, but the Costa Brava and things on the coast of Spain, and that just wasn't floating my boat. And I just, I now realize how I just got sucked in by feeling like I had to, I don't know, social media is wonderful and I love it, but every day I look at Instagram and I'm so inspired by all the incredible people doing incredible things, but you also think, oh gosh, you know, do I need to be doing that? You know, do I need to be like, and no, I don't. But at that moment in time, I thought I did. And I am really, really happy I did that week, because it made me really realize that that's not what it's about. I never had an answer. You know, that's not right. And I won't ever let that happen again. And I am very aware that comparison is the thief of joy, and I won't let that ever happen to me again.
Yes, I think that's a very healthy realization. And I think there's also something in what you were describing about being sort of internally motivated versus externally motivated. So being motivated for something that's very close to you versus a vanity type of performance metric or something along those lines.
Yes, and I think, I am an externally motivated person, in the sense of I need, like, some people can just get up and train. I mean, it can be, you know, the worst weather in the world, but they just go out there and do it. I'm not that person. I'm sitting on the sofa watching reality TV. You know, I'm one of those awful people. you know, I need a goal. I need a level of people to kind of know what I'm doing. I don't know, say I set, I don't know, say I enter a race, I do tell people I'm doing that race because I need that to that be less lazy. Yeah, so that I don't want to, I haven't, you know, I don't win these races. That's fine with me. I'm there to compete against myself. But I'm proud enough that I want to do at least the best I can.
Right.
So there isn't a level of knowing that I do have that external motivation that I do need. But yeah, it's a fine line to be doing things for likes.
Likes or ego or those kinds of things. How many people praise you around how tough or cool or whatever you are.
I didn't think I at all would have ever fallen down that trap. And that's why I wonder if it's just that comparison to maybe 10 years ago when everything was, it was before social media, but everything was really kind of exciting and all happening. And now, as much as life is wonderful and I can't complain about it at all, the adventures are just very much, you know, my things.
Right.
You know, they're not life-changing. they're not newsworthy. And I worried whether that was okay. And now I realize in 6 days of my life that went horribly wrong, yeah, that is okay.
Right. That's a beautiful story. I think that's a very healthy way of looking at it, and probably one that will help a lot of others that are, you know, doing either thinking about doing more of the kind of thing that you've done or what have you. I think it's incredibly important to understand why you're, you know, why anyone's doing anything. Cool.
Yeah.
Could we talk a little bit about some of your cycling adventures? And you cycled across Europe, and the Transcontinental Race, and most recently the Silk Road Mountain Race, which I'm fascinated by all of those events. And I'm just wondering, did you take up cycling at some point, or was it just did you always ride a bike? Or when was the? I know you cycled across Africa, but when was the first time? Is that the first time you kind of, okay?
I don't think of cycling across Africa as cycling. In fact, I kind of forget it was on a bike because we bought the bikes in the Sahara Desert, where, funnily enough, there aren't many bikes, which I hadn't really thought through when we decided to get some bikes when we got there. The bikes were 40 years old, maybe. No brakes, no gears, rusty, like... No, the seats like didn't stay level. I had to pack things under the back of the seat just so it would stay level. I mean, I pushed my bike as much as I rode my bike through Africa. So I kind of, it was a wonderful adventure, but it wasn't a cycling thing really. So really I took up cycling when I moved to France. Mm-hmm. And that was because I didn't know anybody. And as much as living in a ski resort is wonderful, obviously in the winter it's filled with holidaymakers. Mm-hmm. So you don't really know who's a holidaymaker, who lives here. It's quite hard to make friends, or you make friends, but a lot of people that work here are seasonal, so they're gone again, you know, the middle of April. So it's quite hard to make proper friends who live here, particularly in the winter. So cycling is just a big thing out here. So you have, you know, lovely mountains, and it seemed that that's what everyone does when it comes to the summer season. So my parents bought me a cheap secondhand bike for Christmas, and a friend bought me an entry to the Étape de Tour, which is the one stage cycle sportif of the Tour de France, for that summer. And that's how it started.
So and how long ago was this?
7 years ago, maybe.
Okay.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I got on the bike in the May, and there were a couple of like ladies friendly social cycle clubs around here. And so I kind of turned up knowing nothing. I was actually wearing a bum bag on the first cycle. And they're like, no.
Right.
Sort your kids out.
Yeah.
Like, well, where's my carry things? I'm so lacking in knowledge. And then by the July, I did the Étape de Tour, which was an incredibly hard day on the bike for me when I'd only been riding a bike for 8 weeks. So
that's pretty impressive. Yeah, I've done the Étape, and it's not easy.
All day.
Yeah.
No, But yeah, it was just a great way of meeting people, and also learning about the place I live. You know, on the bike, you know more than your valley, because you climb all these wonderful mountains, and it replaced. So when I left the UK, I left behind eventing and horses, and so it was something to fill that void as well. As much as I will never be competitive on a bike like I was on a horse, as in successfully, it fills that void of needing to do something. So that started that first summer, and then was it the next? I can't remember. It might have even been the next summer I entered the Transcontinental. Mm-hmm. Yes, it was. I mean, I was, when I stood at the start line of the Transcontinental bike race, it was a 4,200-kilometer unsupported bike race across Europe. I most definitely was the most inexperienced cyclist on that start line, but it was the element of adventure for me that really appealed, rather than the.
And you said you hadn't met your cycling partner.
That's correct.
Right.
So I entered as a pair because my parents thought it was the safest
option. Thing to do, sure.
So I entered as a pair, and then about 3 or 4 weeks before the start, my friend decided ultra cycling wasn't for and pulled out.
Right.
And I was happy to have a go on my own. But,
okay.
That was overruled. So I had to go about trying to find a somebody to do it with. And living in such a cycling mecca that I do, you'd think it'd be really easy to find someone. No one was remotely interested.
The Transcontinental is a bit mental, I have to say.
Well, I thought it sounded fun. But,
No.
but no one else agreed with me. So
yeah, after
I
all of you, all the things that you did.
And a friend of a friend who knew someone suggested it to this girl. We spoke once on Skype, I met her at the start line, Jane. She's been racing her bike for 15 years. She's phenomenal on a bike. She's so strong. I mean, gosh, did she have to wait for me? Poor girl. But I learned so much from riding with her that I was incredibly grateful that she ended up being my teammate, because her skill on the bike was incredible. Mm-hmm. Her skill on navigation and organization and getting up on time and things like that were rubbish. So we had
good complementarity.
To each other.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But it was, the race. It's not a bike race.
No.
It's just a survival race of ailments that you're dealing with on a daily basis. Sleep deprivation was incredibly tough by the second week. I had cycle palsy really bad. My left hand was completely paralyzed, so I had to change gear with my right hand, which was also a bit dodgy. I couldn't, do up my clothes. I couldn't hold a knife and fork. There's lots of things like that. I had no skin at all on my nether regions from day two. and Jane neither. We were in some pain. Lots of ailments, but the camaraderie on those races, I've done lots since the Transcontinental, and that's what makes them so special. It doesn't matter if you're at the front of the pack or the back of the pack, everybody is just willing everybody to keep going. And quite often we'd come across literally broken, crying men sat on the side of the road in some remote European country, and they're just, you'd stop because you always have a quick chat with people, because it's lovely to see a fellow cyclist in pain also. And you'd speak, and that's it, they're done, they're in tears, they said they're going home, they can't hack it anymore. And in a 5-minute chat, everyone's lifted each other's spirits, and on everyone carries. So yeah, it's a phenomenal race, but sadly it wasn't to be for me that year. I got 3,200 kilometers in. I was actually in Albania when it went horribly wrong for me. Well, actually it went horribly wrong probably a couple of countries before that. I'd got to the point where my mouth was basically one big ulcer. I suffer under stressful situations, I suffer from ulcers and acid spots.
Yep.
And in those Baltic countries, we weren't really eating proper for food. We were only getting like garbage food from petrol stations, very sugary, really just bad food. And I just couldn't eat it. And then I'd lost my appetite, and it basically, I just was in the red probably for 3 days unknowingly. And in Albania, it was about plus 40 degrees, and I was cycling along and just collapsed while cycling along on the side of the road. And that was me done. There was no recovery from that.
Okay.
It had happened too long before, if you know what I mean, to even we did take 12 hours off, and Jane stayed with me in the hope that I'd recover, but I wasn't coming back from that. So I gave her all the GPS files and sent her on her way, and talked her through the directions on the phone for the next few days.
Did she finish?
She finished. She was the only female to finish that year. There were 10 females started out of 200 racers. Jane was the only female to finish. Jane and I were actually the only ladies still in it at the last checkpoint four. So we were doing good. And I think about 70 people finished overall. So it's a survival race, you know. It's, but they're wonderful races. I love them.
Well, I'd love to transition to the Silk Road mountain race, because that's a similar... sounds to me like a similar race. I'm not done either, but you know, it's right. You have to be strong. Well, I don't know if you have to be strong on the bike, but you have to be, you know, you have to cycle, but you also have to be good at navigation, organization, recovery, nutrition, you know, repairing your bike, all of that good stuff. So what motivated you to take part in that one?
The Silk Road Mountain Race was probably the best, if not nearly the best, 2 weeks of my life ever. It was incredible. I loved it. Soon as I saw the race kind of pop up on social media, I didn't even give it a second thought. I entered immediately because it was somewhere remote, and that's my my thing. I will never be a particularly good bike rider. I will never be fast. I'm never going to win one of those kind of races. That's not the kind of bike rider I am. But what I can do is look after myself in remote parts of the world where weather conditions and things like that mean you need to be on your game. And so I just knew that was going to be somewhere that suited me. And I'd always wanted to go to Kyrgyzstan. I loved the nomadic culture. You know, it's on the border of China, so I was going to get that similar kind of vibe that I had in China. It was a mountain bike race. I didn't even own a mountain bike race. I've never really done any mountain biking, so I did have to buy a bike for it. But again, I wouldn't call it a bike race. I pushed that bike more than I rode that bike, through Kyrgyzstan. It was about just looking after yourself. And there were so few people that finished because nothing to do with their bike skills. They were just out of their depth in those mountains. You know, I'm very fortunate to live in the mountains. I know what the weather can do when you're at 4,000 meters in altitude and how quickly it can change. And things which I think perhaps, you know, if you've come from a city, that's a whole world away. Why would you know? So I think it surprised a few people. And I think a few people, didn't finish because it kind of just psychologically got the better of them, not even physically. It was a wonderful race. I'm so jealous of all the people who are doing it this year. It was 1,700 kilometers long. We had a 14-day limit to get round, and it did take me 14 days. There were just 29 of us that finished from the 100
starters. Congratulations. That's amazing.
You always know you can do things better. Sadly, I got pneumonia on day by day two, and I was very poorly for day two, three, and four. In fact, quite a few of us got pneumonia, and everyone else had to pull out. But I was carrying a monster first aid kit. I think my first aid kit was bigger than everybody else's put together. And I had, you know, three different types of antibiotics. I had all sorts of stuff, because there is no one coming to get you.
There are no hospitals or pharmacies.
Exactly. You know, so I've been in those situations before. Medical kit's light. It's not worth not taking. So I was fortunate enough to know what I was feeling, and that I had the drugs to sort that. So I took the drugs very quickly and was able to kind of stay on top of it. But it definitely lost me maybe at least a day. But hey, finishing was really the only aim of the game. But yeah, the people were amazing. The scenery was mind-blowing. I just wish I was there again. I loved every second of it. And loads of people are calling it, you know, the hardest bike race in the world. And I just thought it was the best thing ever.
Right.
And they're like, are you sure you're doing the same race? But it was just my cup of tea. And 2 months previous, I'd done a big bike ride around France. Mm-hmm. I did the 1911 original Tour de France route, which was so much harder.
Really?
I found that so tough.
Why is that? Is that because of the distance you had to cover versus, well, I guess in some ways the Silk Road race suits your skill set in terms of adventure and survival and decision making and those kinds of things. But what was it about the France route that was more challenging?
So the French route, so just to give you some very quick stats on it, that it was just under 5,500 kilometers. The reason why it's the first of the modern Tour de France is it was the first tour that you went over the Pyrenees and the Alps, which it has done every year ever since. So that's why they call it the first. And it was, 5,500 kilometers, and it was done in 15 stages. So the stages averaged 350 kilometers, the longest being 470 kilometers. Mm-hmm. So, and my plan was to ride each stage as a stage, as they did, no support. If I needed a 15-minute power nap on the side of the road, I took one, just as they did back then. And the cycling wasn't a problem, but within the 23 days, which was the reason why I chose 23 days to do it in, is because that's the time that the modern Tour de France take, albeit they do 2,000 kilometers less.
Right, double that.
But just by the third week, the lack of sleep was unreal. I was basically getting about 6 hours sleep every 3 days.
Wow.
It's a bit complicated, but the way it worked meant our day was one and a half of a normal day. So we knew we couldn't, like when you do the transcontinental, for example, you still have a 24-hour day and you sleep as much of that or as little as that as you choose. Mm-hmm. Generally, you might be on the bike 20 hours and then get a couple of hours sleep, and then you get on the bike and you do another 20 hours. And actually, your body, it does get tired, and sleep deprivation is a problem, but it's a pattern that the body understands. Mm-hmm. As where when we're doing the Tour de France, it would sometimes take us 27 hours to finish a stage.
Right.
Then we'd have a little bit of a sleep, but by then it might be daytime. So the body doesn't like sleeping, so you'd have a very broken sleep, and then you'd get on the bike and do another maybe 28 hours on the bike. And it just meant it was kind of every 3 days before you got a nighttime slot of sleeping.
Right.
And then you might get a good 6 hours. And 3 weeks in that, I was an absolute mess. I could not keep my eyes open when it got dark. I was just terrified of being on the bike. I was seeing triple of everything. I kept falling asleep. The amount of cars, you split second, you fall asleep and the bike drifts off. And I was terrified I was going to die all the time when it was night. And, I've been to some very wild places. I've been, to the Arctic Ocean, I've been to the Patagonian ice caps and Gobi deserts, and the most scared I've ever been about dying has been on the roads of my home country. I found that a lot tougher. And I think on the road bike, doing those kind of races, I love my road bike, don't get me wrong, but it's hard to stay with it. Whereas when you're on the mountain bike in somewhere like Kyrgyzstan, every moment is wow, like the scenery is wow.
Right.
You have to concentrate on every stone when you're going down, you know, tricky tracks and things like that. So you're a lot more, your brain is a lot more alive, as where on the road bike, it's pretty monotonous at times. And that's really mentally tough to stay enjoying it and awake.
Right. Yeah. I can see that. And for both of these things, you had a partner, right? Is that correct? Or
Both of these with my boyfriend Lee, and he is cycling is his thing. He loves cycling. He was cycling long before I was, but he was definitely a one day sportif, cycle up hill as fast as you can kind of cycle rider.
Yeah.
And I've introduced him to this new world. And he says he likes it. I hope he's not just doing.
Yeah, it is a different world. Yeah, I mean, I can see the appeal of it, but I think it gets a little bit of, you know, it takes some getting used to, because it's like, well, we're going what, half-assed, you know. So how important in those cases is having a partner?
Oh, so I've never really done much solo trips. I'm actually heading off in July to cross Iceland solo, because I just really want to just see how I cope on my own.
Right.
Because I've done so many things with usually one person. I've done a couple of kind of teams of three, but most of it with just with one person. And as much as I'm really interested in doing solo, I think I will always love being with a teammate. I love having someone to share those stories with, you know, do you remember when? I love that aspect of it. But more importantly, you have someone to pick you up when you are low.
Yes.
And the body has an incredible, I don't know if there's any science behind it, but it 100% is definitely true that you will never both be having a low at the same time.
Right. Yeah, I agree.
On every trip I've ever done.
Yeah.
You know, we all have bad times, all of us, and the other person will always be doing all right, and they'll pick you up, and they'll, you know, and that will be vice versa. So yeah, on my really low days, you know, on the Tour de France, Lee gave me a good talking to, told me to pull my socks up. And likewise, you know, there were days when he was just like, this isn't what riding your bike's about. I don't love riding my bike at the moment.
Right.
And I'd be like, it'll be worth it when you've finished, I promise. you know, so yeah, I personally think riding with a teammate is great. But actually, if you look at the statistics, particularly on these ultra distance bike races, most teams don't finish.
That's interesting.
Most teams only, or one person finishes, and that's generally because they go as mates. I think being, you know, my partner, we know each other very well. I swear, if you decided to do it, you know, with a mate that's into cycling, you'll both have slightly different agendas. One of you probably had the idea and the other one went along with it when you signed up in the first place. So someone wants it a bit more. Yeah, you don't see many pairs finish these things, even though on paper you think as a pair you should be stronger. But it doesn't seem to work out that
way. That's so interesting.
But also I find there's usually, I tend to divvy out roles and we stick to our roles and you don't mess with each other's roles.
That's
that way
great.
You can't argue.
Yeah, love that.
Yeah.
Because if you can make it a sort of, you know, you're a team, or you're an entity that's bigger than, you know, the sum of the both of you individually, I imagine that helps.
Yes. And I think in Kyrgyzstan, particularly, it was great to have a team. Just some of the decisions, well, I'm not trying not to sound too over dramatic, but you know, some decisions in Kyrgyzstan, where you stopped, where you slept, were big decisions, because if you got it wrong, you could be hypothermic very, very quickly.
How did you make those decisions?
For both Lee and I, they were very obvious decisions, but I think that's because
you're familiar with mountains.
Live in the mountains. Lee's a ski instructor. I've done lots of mountainous expeditions, so we understand the altitude. We understand the weather patterns and things. So it's it didn't feel difficult decisions. But I think for some other people who, you know, there were people who were hypothermic on tops of mountains that were being collected and all sorts of things. You know, they perhaps didn't have that other person to just, I don't know, if you have a thought process, sometimes it's just nice to speak it out loud
and validate it. Yeah,
I agree with that. Yeah. So I think that in Kyrgyzstan, it just gave you that, reassurance that you made the right decision, or you were making the right decision.
So, or it's just a sense check that, oh, yeah, are you sure you want to do that? You know, I think this is better.
Yeah,
I can see that.
Yeah.
Physically, was there anything that you did specifically to well, I guess, you know, I rode around France. So I guess that's, you know, that was a key factor. But is it more of a mental adventuring type of challenge versus a physical challenge? What's the balance? Do you think? You said the lot of, you know, very good cyclists just didn't complete it.
Yeah, a lot of people on Kyrgyzstan, more than perhaps I've seen on Transcon and similar, when I spoke to them, they were just, their only answer was they were done. Right. On other races, you know, sometimes, you know, the bike breaks or you get an injury or whatever else. They just said they were like just done, like emotionally, mentally
broken.
And I think a lot of that, this is just my assumption, is actually almost, fear might be a bit stronger word, but when you read the expedition pack, as it were, before you go, you know you're going into certain areas which are rightly kind of bigged up in all the text. So people are, I think, worrying about what's ahead more than they needed to, because, you know, the unknown is nerve-wracking. That's, you know, a natural instinct in us all. And so I think some people kind of just used up a lot of mental, physical exhaustion from what's coming. You know, like the last climb was regarded as going to be the worst. It was, you know, waiting for Shamshi Pass, which is going to be the hiker bike. I mean, I'd hiked a bike for 2 weeks before I got to the hiker bike section. So, you know, if you were thinking through everything, all you could think was, this is only going to get harder. This is going to get harder. So if you were struggling already, I think that alone just made people think, oh God, this is just too much for me. Whereas actually, if you broke each thing down, none of them were, in my opinion, frightening or a problem. Or maybe just for me, it was my happy place. I just love those kind of conditions.
And I guess
I'm just not a city girl, maybe.
I guess the lesson there is just deal with what's in front of you, perhaps.
Yes,
be present. Yeah.
I did cycle for quite a bit with one guy in particular, and he pulled out after checkpoint one purely for the fear of what was coming. He just thought he wasn't ready. I'm like, you don't know what's there. You'll be great. I knew he physically could cycle it. He was a much stronger a very experienced mountain biker, but he'd never done a race like this. And I think just that unknown just got the better of him, and he wasn't willing to take the chance on it. But I know he'll go back and be ready another time. But so I think it definitely wasn't so much a physical thing for people in Kyrgyzstan, but just everything. You have to make sure you've got enough food, you know. You don't know when you're going to get your next food, and things like that worried people, you know. Or they got sick with food, or it was all sorts going on. But the riding a bike was really irrelevant. I didn't do it very much. I just pushed my bike around.
That's so interesting.
But
I know we're struggling to, you know, we've got to wrap up soon, but I'd be curious to get your take. Maybe if we just took a step back and I don't know if you had any thoughts on decision-making and risk-taking throughout the various adventures that you did, something that perhaps you could share with some of my listeners around how to make a tough decision or how to approach uncertainty or the unknowns, maybe something that you share in some of your talks that might resonate.
I would definitely say I am not a risk-averse person. Obviously, I value my health, and I don't want to put myself in any level of great danger. Mm-hmm. But I even like in daily life, my family, that kind of what I've grown up with, my parents are risk takers in business. You know, mm-hmm. we've been rich, we've been poor, we've been rich, we've been poor. You know, that they're just happy to have a go. They'll always find, if it goes wrong, we'll sort it. You know, there's a solution. We'll come back from it. So, I've always kind of had that attitude. My partner actually, Lee, kind of comes from the opposite, and he's always kind of been a save for the rainy day. Mm-hmm. And between us, we're finding a happy medium.
Find a balance, yeah.
Whereas I'm very much living for now, and we'll worry about tomorrow then. Mm-hmm. Because you know, there is always a solution. So I'm not risk averse. Doesn't mean I'm brave. I wouldn't say I'm definitely not a kind of adrenaline junkie, daredevil kind of brave person. That's you know, I have no desire to do scary things, or that's not my thing. I'm happy at challenging myself physically and mentally, but that doesn't mean I kind of I'm not into adrenaline as such.
Yeah.
But so risk. I've never on an expedition like I've never thought, oh, I don't want to do that in case I can't do it or I can't fail. Those things don't really come into my mind. I either like the idea or like the concept, or I don't. Like there's many things I wouldn't be interested in. You know, someone asked me to climb K2 not in a million years.
Right.
You know, that to me is a level of risk I'm not willing to take. But I don't have a problem with taking a risk that I might not be able to do what I'm going to do. Mm. That level of risk doesn't bother me.
And how much preparation do you say you tend to do ahead of all of these challenges?
I love planning as much as I love doing the expeditions.
That's so interesting.
I organize other people's expeditions.
Yes.
I love it. I research, I can plan, I can play with maps and make notes and write Excel sheets and do GPS files till I'm blue in the face.
Yes.
I love it. And actually sometimes if it's a really big trip, which could seem quite scary, I plan it almost as if I'm not the person going. I just get sucked into the planning. So I am a planner. I wouldn't say I'm massively good at the training aspect. I do train, again, from that accountability. You know, I just don't want to fail miserably.
Sure. Right.
But I'm not, I've never followed a training plan in my life. I'm not particularly dedicated.
Yeah, I take them as guidelines.
Yeah. I love.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I've never even looked at one. Really.
Right, okay, great.
I literally, if I go out riding, I go out riding to be outside, with friends, going up the New Col, or it's very much, none of it's really training. It's, I do sport because I like being outside. So on paper, I'm very organized. Routes, things like that. I'm very good at weighing kit and finding the lightest kit there is out there to purchase, and making sure I've really, really researched the best kit for the job. But from a training aspect, I could do better.
Right. Well, what I found fascinating with your response there is how much you talked about, well, I love planning. And I'm just reminded, you've seen Free Solo, I take it, or maybe you haven't.
I haven't yet.
Oh, wow.
On the to-do list.
Okay. So at the risk of a spoiler alert, Alex Honnold, he declares that he's not an adrenaline junkie, just like you, and he does so much planning as well, and that's fascinating to me that that planning is a key component of doing the types of things that you've done.
Yeah, well, my ex husband before I met him used to base jump a lot and skydive and I can't remember exactly the words he put it, but you know, I associate people that base jump as, you know, real kind of woohoo adrenaline junkies,
right,
like living for the moment, don't really care if they live or die. And he's like, gosh, it is it actually, with the base jumping, it's so the opposite. They're so calculated. Mm. Everything is to the precision moment because, you know, it can go horribly wrong.
The stakes are so high.
Yes, and everything was very mathematically done, and it was, very, very planned. But in my head, it was just these crazy people that just kind of jumped without even, it's almost as if they weren't thinking it through. But it turned out to be very much the opposite. I think if you don't plan, you've got a higher chance of not coming out the other way. So I'll keep planning.
Fantastic. We've covered a lot of ground, and I know we're probably running out of time, but was there anything that we didn't get a chance to cover that you wanted to mention?
No, nothing specific. I mean, I've been to all sorts of places and have all sorts of stories, but they're all long in their own right, so we probably shouldn't start anymore. Well, or we'll never stop.
I feel like we could go off for hours and hours, but I think we do need to wrap it up. But this has been fascinating. This has been a wonderful chat. Before we go, where can my listeners learn more about you and find you on social media and all of that good stuff?
Yep. So I have a website, which is katiejaneendurance.com, and I have blogs and lots of information about my trips, and it's something that I'd really like to do more. I'd like to do more kind of kit reviews and things like that, but never seem to find the time. But it's definitely on the to-do list. And I do quite a lot on, I enjoy it in Instagram for it's got many benefits and many negatives, but I do enjoy Instagram, and I'm Katie Jane Endurance on there as well. They're really the two places you can find me, and that's me really.
That's fantastic. Katie, this was a lot of fun. This was great. So I just wanted to thank you for taking the time to chat.
Not at all. Thank you very much for having me, and sorry, I hope I didn't go off on too many random tangents.
No, I love it. We live in a society characterized by, social media, lots of snippets and short bursts of content, and I think we've lost a little bit as a society the art of, conversation and long form discussions, and so many wonderful things come out just by wandering around a little bit. And I think that's great.
Absolutely. But sadly, almost every trip is almost its own, its own story in its own right. So it's quite hard to be concise and get some of the information across, because, every trip is so different, and every trip I've learned something completely different about the world, the people, myself.
I can understand.
Despite having 5 years of studying at university, I've definitely learned a whole lot more about myself and the world from doing adventure than I did studying. So,
Well, I suppose maybe before we go, I think that's a great lesson for everyone to be a little bit more adventurous, even in small ways with different things. Because I, you're right, I think we all learn a little bit more when we embrace uncertainty.
I believe so. And I have, I don't know if it's me, but I have a real problem with routine. Not all routine, because sometimes on an expedition, there has to be an element of routine. But I just think sometimes if every day is too similar to the day before, it makes time pass so incredibly quick, because you can't differentiate between your days. And so I really do try and live, even when I'm not off on a big adventure, just on a, day-to-day basis at home, I do try and live with quite an adventurous mindset, and I do try and do things that scare me a little and kind of, I don't know, make every day a little bit different, and therefore each day is extraordinary because it's not the same as the one before. And I'm really an advocate of that, whether that's outside your doorstep, or it doesn't have to be the other side of the world, nearly dying on some ice cap somewhere. But I just think it's very easy to go and 1 week be the same to the week before. And before you know it, you go, oh, how have we got to the end of the year? So I do try and live adventurously, even if it's, on a daily basis, even if it's just, walking outside the house, it's somewhere new, somewhere different. I try and change it up. Yeah, that's that's how I try and live life anyway.
That's wonderful. And that's probably a beautiful place to wrap it up. So, Katie, thank you very much for taking the time to chat.
Not at all. Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Absolute pleasure on our end. Thanks.
All right. I hope you enjoyed that. As usual, check out the show notes to learn more about Katie, her adventures, and her work. And if you did enjoy this, and if you enjoy the show, share it. Give us a positive rating and review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. It helps us out an awful lot. And it's a very quick and inexpensive, in fact, free way you can help us out. That is all for now. We'll be back in 2 weeks. Until then, and as always, don't forget, risk is life.